We're in the Hollywood apartment of Alice Reinhart this morning, and we're going to talk with a gal who's had a very beautiful life and who made a very important name for herself and provided some very great entertainment for us in the radio days as Chi-Chi on a radio series called Life Can Be Beautiful.
Otherwise known in the profession as Elsie Beebe.
Elsie Beebe.
Right.
Right. Because of the
because
initials?
Because of its initials, yes.
Was Life Can Be Beautiful considered the top of the so-called soap operas?
Well, I'm sure it was one of the tops. It was one of the very few, or perhaps the only one, I'm not sure of this, that was on all three networks every day for about 2 years of its life. It went on NBC from 11 to 11:15, and CBS from 1 to 1:15, and Mutual from 2 to 2:15. And the NBC and CBS were both live because they wouldn't allow recordings on those two networks ever until tape came in, or they allowed air checks and things of that sort. But Mutual played it as a recording, so we only had to go to two stations to do it every day.
Well, which one did they record for Mutual then?
I have no idea.
One of the two.
One of the two, huh? Yeah.
Why
or maybe Mutual recorded it off the air.
Oh, they may have
done that. They may have done that.
Why was it heard on three networks?
Because it was so popular. And Mutual, of course, hit different areas of the country from CBS and NBC. And there were, I assume, stations that CBS hit that NBC didn't hit or something, but it was full network on both stations.
So we would hear it in Chicago, for example, at one time on NBC and later on CBS. And if there was a Mutual station there, we might have heard it.
That's right.
It was great. You wouldn't have to miss a chapter of it, would you?
No, but you know, like in all soap operas, it didn't matter if you missed a chapter or two or even three, because we recapped every day. And I always tell the silly story about, but it's 'tis true, that it took me 3 weeks on another show called Pretty Kitty Kelly to go up in an elevator from the first to the third floor. So you didn't really miss anything if you missed a day or two of it.
But you really captured the listening audience with the stories. How long was LCBB on?
I believe about 14, 15 years. I was on it for 11.
Were you on it from its inception?
I started it on Labor Day 1938.
Labor Day.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to work on Labor Day.
Had to work on Labor Day. But that was when the show started. And it was kind of an amusing story. I had gone away on vacation with my mother to a dude ranch. Father didn't particularly... Oh, I guess Father was... That was 1938. No, Father died in 1936. But he didn't like dude ranches anyway. So we had gone to this dude ranch, and I got a call to come in and do a reading, and I said, oh, gee, I'm on vacation. They said, come on in anyway. So I went in and did the reading, and that was for Life Can Be Beautiful, and went back out to Jersey to the dude ranch and was happily riding trails and having a wonderful time when I got another call from the agency saying, you've got to come in because we've narrowed it down to two people, and you've got to come in and we have to see. And I said, who is the other person? And they said, Kathleen Nadei. And I said, well, Kay's a very good friend of mine. Give it to her. I want to stay here on my vacation. I'd been working very, very hard. And I had two other five-day-a-week serials at the time called Howie Wing and with Russell Jenny and Her Honor Nancy James with Barbara Weeks. And the gal whom I knew at the agency said, if you ever want to work for this agency again, you better come in here and read for this thing. So I did, and of course I got it. Mother had to come back from the dude ranch, and we had to stay in town then for publicity.
And you were Chi-Chi.
I was Chi-Chi.
Was Chi-Chi her real name, or was
her name was Carol Conrad.
Carol Conrad.
Yes,
yeah.
And she, as a little girl, they called her Cece.
Oh,
and she couldn't pronounce Cece when she was a little girl. This is the explanation.
Yes.
How do I know? You know, I wasn't even there, and so she called herself Chi-Chi. So that was how it came to be.
Was one of the soap operas, it was... Do you prefer it to have it called a soap opera or a daytime drama?
You know, I never was really very sensitive about that, as long as they paid me. And that was kind of an unfortunate thing, too, because I found out 20 years later that I was in the budget for twice what I was getting.
Oh, and somebody was...
Mm-hmm. the producer.
Could you deduct that on your income tax later?
I only found out 20 years later, and as a matter of fact, I was talking to someone today who was a friend of mine, and they said, why don't you find out? And I said, oh, the statute of limitations has long since run out. But the guy is here in California, and I thought, what harm can it do? I'll talk to my lawyer.
That's an interesting thing. Now, you were not a member of did that show originate at NBC or CBS?
It originated at NBC.
It started at NBC. Yes. Were you a member of the Artist Service then, or Artist Bureau at NBC?
Well, the Artist Service hadn't anything to do with that, because this was a separate contract. The Artist Service had to do only with sustaining programs, not sponsored.
Uh-huh. That's where NBC took a 10% off the talent
fee.
The
checks were $25, and we got $18.75 for a sustainer.
$18.75? Mm-hmm. Wow, they took more than 10% off of that then, didn't they?
About 15. And but if you were cast on a sustainer, which I assume your listening audience knows what that is, a program which is not sponsored by a commercial sponsor, or is it a public service program or something, then you went through NBC casting, but not if you were.
Well, you said you got called from the agency, and now you mentioned that you did not get.
Well, Procter & Gamble paid a certain amount for the show. It was one of the highest budgeted shows on the air at that time.
And they were selling Spick and Span mostly.
They were selling Spick and Span and Ivory, Liquid. Mm-hmm. And they sold a number of their products, but Spick and Span was one of our longest. And the production agency of the show was called Transamerica, and the agency was Benton & Bowles. For a while, and they changed agencies. Mm-hmm. Procter & Gamble had a number of different advertising agencies because they had 33 shows a day on the air.
And 33 shows a day?
Mm-hmm.
Were they all the soap opera type?
Most of them, yes.
Mm-hmm. They sold a lot of soap,
they
can imagine.
They certainly did. And, of course, in those days, we didn't ever buy soap. Because we got it free for Christmas. We got an enormous box, and when I did... Her Honor Nancy James, we were on for the Cellutex Corporation. I got 144 boxes of Kleenex for Christmas. It's a lot of Kleenex.
They weren't trying to tell you the blow or anything. But they would give you the sponsor's product for Christmas. Nothing else would they give you.
But that was fine. That was a lot of loot. And I was married to an executive of NBC at the time, and he every year got magnificent baskets full of booze. And so when we had our Christmas party or parties, we never bought any booze. And one year it was very late in coming. The things had been going kind of downhill. This was shortly before the war, and things were kind of rocky. And so I said to him, well, don't you think I better go out and buy some liquor for the parties? And he said, no, let's wait another day. So I said, all right. And he worked at nights. He was night program manager of NBC. And he came home about 1 o'clock in the morning, and he said, well, the basket came. One of the baskets came. And I said, oh, good, fine, where is it? And he took his hand out from behind his back and brought a little tiny basket, like a little Easter basket, full of Tums. That was the sponsor that usually sent the liquor. So
was on an austerity program.
Was on
that
an austerity
year.
Program. So that was the end. About the end of the big gifts from sponsors. Mm-hmm. Except that NBC out here, when we came out, when Les Tremaine and I came out, we were married at the time, to do The Woman in My House for Carlton E. Morris. NBC always gave us a piece of Steuben glass for Christmas, which was kind of nice. But that was, I don't know, the big execs at NBC and CBS, of course, got tremendous amount of stuff, like the big columnists always got here.
Was that, would you call that payola?
No, it wasn't
Gift-ola?
Really a payola. It was giftola. No, there wasn't, it wasn't.
It didn't have that
connotation in those days. People gave presents for Christmas, and they gave them to the people that worked for and with them. And I do know this much, that we were forbidden finally, and one gal was fired from casting at NBC because the actors gave her such lovely presents, and there was no favoritism. I can vouch for that. There was no favoritism involved at all in this girl. And she was forced to resign because one Christmas she got so much. But I don't know whether they had had someone squeal on her or what, or somebody complained that they weren't being used on the shows or something like that, and that she was getting too much. And then we were forbidden to give anybody in the department anymore.
What was your first radio job?
The Great American Applebee's, 1927.
1927?
The basement of the Lowe's Warfield Theater on Market Street in San Francisco.
Well, now, how did that come about?
Well, I had gone to an acting academy. Reginald Travers was very famous in San Francisco at the time. And I studied with him, and he also had a stock repertory company in San Francisco called the Players Guild, and I worked in that. And in conjunction with that, he had this little radio program called The Great American Applebee's, which was the first soap opera that had ever been heard of, I think, in California at any rate. And I played Alice Appleby, and that was the first radio program I ever did. And then we had another one, which we did dramatized operas and great plays like Thais and things of that kind, with the music as background, only acted dramatically otherwise. We didn't get paid for that, of course, and there was no sponsorship. And there's only one studio, and I remember that the musicians who had the program previous to us, it was a combo that had a popular music program, and their theme song was "Where the Sweet Little Violets Grow," and I'll never forget it. And as they were coming out of the studio, our announcer was scooching into the studio to get in front of the mic so there wouldn't be too much airspace, and then we would all group around, and we had rehearsed, of course, somewhere else. And then we would do our program. So those were the conditions that existed in 1927.
What kind of a reaction did you get from the listening audience for
None.
The program?
None. At least not that I knew of. Nobody ever told me of any. I was busy in the theater, and I was busy in radio, and I was busy going to school, taking dancing and singing and music lessons and everything that I could cram down.
Did you think you might find a career for yourself in radio, or did you think it would be more the stage?
I don't think radio ever occurred to us then, because it wasn't that much of a medium. In 1927, very few people had radio sets. I don't know about crystal sets. I never really was terribly interested in radio, and I say this to my everlasting shame, because I now think it was the most beautiful medium we ever had, until I went to New York. And found that the theater was not going to crack wide open and lay itself at my feet. And I worked hard, but I had 16 flops in 8 years. And it was not exactly the most lucrative business in the world. And I had gone to Europe with my parents and played in Berlin, both in German and in English, when I was 20. And I had started a little bit in radio then, when NBC was still at 711 Fifth Avenue before they moved to Rockefeller Center. They had originally had their offices before they were the Red and the Blue and the National Broadcasting Company down at 195 Broadway in New York. Then they moved up to the posh section on Fifth Avenue, 711. And then in 1936, I think it was, we moved into the RCA building. But when I came back from Europe, was right after the crash, and my father had lost everything, and I was in sole charge of taking care of the family. So I had to make the best living I could, and radio seemed at that time to be more lucrative than the theater. And while I hopped back and forth a good bit, nevertheless, I was one of the few people in those days who had had radio training of any kind. So those programs in San Francisco paid off.
So you were working then on the stage in New York and in radio in New York.
In radio in New York, yes.
Now, how did Alice Reinhart take care of both of those things? How did you do the
Well,
two?
It was simple when I was working in a play. But most of them, as I say, didn't last very long when I was working in a play. I couldn't do radio, and when I was, whenever I got, because I was stage struck and still am, I'd go back on stage any minute if anybody'd let me. I would simply, I didn't have a serial at the time. We did shows like 20,000 Years in Sing Sing and K7, which was a spy thing, but there were, I always played lady spies, and because I was a dialectician, and all spies in those days were foreign. No such thing as American spy, anything like that. And in 20,000 Years in Sing Sing, I either played a Mal or a lady convict, female convict, or a secretary or something of that sort. And I was on it constantly. And we had a good cast. But then one of the directors, Joe Bell, who was now returned to acting, said to me once, if you go back to the theater once more, I'm not going to cast you anymore. People were always threatening me. And so I said, all right, Joe, and then I got some regular parts and things, and Howie Wing. And
well, you really were probably, if not the, at least one of the busiest actresses in radio.
Probably.
From about that time on until actually the waning days of radio,
well,
which would be the late 50s.
We went off in... Dramatic radio actually folded in 1959, and we folded right with it at that time, because we had done The Woman in My House for Carlton Morse out here for 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
We came out for that particular program, and Les wanted to go into pictures and live television. I turned up my nose at live television because I think largely, I had done some of it in New York, but I think largely because it made me nervous. Crawling under cameras and changing right out in front of everybody because you had to, and trying to come on looking fresh and serene was just not my cup of tea. And live television was like that. You had to, you would walk out of a frame, supposedly a door, and the sound man would close the door behind you, and then you get down on all fours and crawl under the camera between the cameraman's legs and out to where the wardrobe woman was waiting to put something on you, and the makeup man was waiting to dab some more gook on your face, and then in order to get back in frame, you would have to go around the back of something to get to the other side of the of the stage, and it was terribly complicated to me. And I don't know why it should have been, but it was, and I just didn't like it, so I wouldn't do live television. When they got filmed, then I wasn't well-known enough to, until I had to beat the doors down again.
You did a lot of the, as you say, the 20,000 Years in Sing Sing. You did a lot of the evening prime, so-called. They didn't call it prime time in the radio days, did they?
No, not
it was
in
just
those days. I did, when I was over at 7-Eleven Fifth Avenue, I did the Goldbergs with Gertie and Jimmy Waters, and Maggie and Jiggs. Aggie Moorhead was on that, and she played Maggie, and I played an awful lot of shows over there, K7 and Sing Sing. And
you mentioned dialects. What kind of dialects did you do?
I speak four languages, and have spoken. I'm bilingual or trilingual in German and Spanish and English. And the French my mother taught me when I was little. She had finished her education in Paris. And so I did at least those four, but I did most European dialects.
Mm-hmm.
And I never forget, there was an actor, a comedian, called Charlie Cantor in New York. And no relation to Eddie Cantor, but... and he did a lot of dialects, too. He was a good dialectician. And one evening, quite late in the afternoon, 5:30 thereabouts, I got a call from NBC saying, could I come down and do, now I've forgotten the name of the show, Showboat, that evening. And
Captain Henry's Showboat, is that
yes,
the one?
Yes, Tiny Ruffner was the announcer, and Molasses and January were on it. And I said, well, yeah, I guess so. And it was a dress show because it was done in Studio 8H. This was after we had already moved into the RCA building, and 8H sat 1,500 people. And we always dressed the men in tuxedo and the gals in evening gowns. And I had just come back from Cleveland from doing some stock there. And I had some awfully pretty clothes that I had gotten from the stock company. The local couturier had made the dresses for us and then given them to us, which I thought was terribly nice. It was good publicity for them. And I had, it was summertime, and I had a frothy white organdy dress with great big green polka dots and frills and bows and everything, and I was very slender in those days. And I put that on, and I went down, and we had dressing rooms, and Molasses in January came down to the dressing room, and we were going to rehearse, and I asked what I was playing, and the casting gal said, "The Chinese Laundryman." And I said, all right. And I heard Charlie Cantor in the next dressing room say, "We not only have to buck the stand-up comics, but now we have to buck the dames, too." So he was pretty angry about it, I guess. But they wanted a lighter voice, and I had a deep voice for a feminine voice, and I could play it with a no ticky, no lonely kind of thing. So I played the Chinese Laundryman. Now, this, of course, was one of the great faults of the audience shows in those days, too. Because when I stepped out in front of the audience in my frilly gown and started to play the Chinese Laundryman with Molasses in January, the audience fell off their seats with laughter, and it wasn't that funny at home because they didn't know what was going on.
Well, the audience really had a treat because Molasses in January were two white men playing two black men.
That's right.
Didn't they do it in blackface for the local audience?
I think they did. Yes. Yes, I'm pretty sure they did. But
here's this lovely lady in a white
playing
gown.
Chinese laundry.
Well, that's like in a number of some of the gals on radio were played by men. Marlon Hurt played Beulah, the maid. And that always got a big laugh because a man would walk up to the microphone and the conversation, the lines would all of
sure,
a sudden
it's
bring
like
a lady.
Jonathan Winters now, who plays all kinds of dialect gals in his.
You said that you got a call late from NBC to do this thing. Did that happen very often in the radio days?
It happened only on occasion, I think. The reason that the people used to complain so terribly that they couldn't get into radio, that we were a cliquey business, wasn't so much the actors that were keeping them out. It wasn't us at all, as a matter of fact. The directors had to have people they could depend on. They had to have experienced people who knew what a microphone was, who knew enough not to project the way they would in the theater. Theater people tried desperately later on. They called it a bastard art at first, and then they tried desperately later on to get in when they found out that the bastards were paying the money, you know. But we had our hour and a half rehearsal for the shorter shows and 2 or 3 hours for the big shows mostly. The show that rehearsed the most was Gangbusters. We had 2 or 3 days rehearsal and no conflicts allowed. But
no, a conflict is...
Well, that meant that now if you, for example, had two shows where the shows didn't coincide and run coincidentally, but the rehearsals sometimes did, and you would say to your one director, "Can I come in just for the dress rehearsal?" And he would say yes, because you'd played the part before or because he knew you could do it. And you would go to the other director and say, "I have to go over to NBC from CBS for a dress rehearsal at such and such a time. Is that okay?" And he'd say, "Sure, go ahead." No, Phil wouldn't allow this. You took his job and you stayed there the whole time that you did it. But he paid better than any other half-hour show at the time, and he paid $50, which, of course, nowadays isn't even scale.
Well, was there, was this before AFRA came in on the scene?
No, this was under AFRA. AFRA, as I remember it, because I was one of the charter members, came on the scene about 1938. Or 39. And yes, I guess Gangbusters was before AFRA. But even so, AFRA scale in those days was very low. Mm-hmm. Then your dollar was worth more, it bought a lot more. Yeah. And we were, if we earned $150 a week, we were well paid, and could afford to take vacations and everything else.
Mm-hmm. Well, there were a lot of, if you did a number of shows a week, even if you were getting what was, if not AFRA minimum, at least industry minimums,
yes,
you could still earn a fairly good living.
Except for some of the soaps which brought AFRA about.
Were the soaps that brought AFRA about?
Well, three people who shall be nameless. One was a nighttime producer and a soap opera producer, and the others were soap producers. And they paid $5.85 for two shows, show and repeat. Because, you see, most of our shows had to be repeated for the West Coast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We had, if they went on at 11:15 in New York, it was 2:15 or 3 o'clock out here. And sometimes they wanted them on in the mornings, too, so mm-hmm. we'd have to do them at 8 in the morning in New York, and then again at 11:15 for the New York, for the Eastern Seaboard. But $5.85 for two shows was unheard of. That was even worse than the Artist Bureau. The sustainers, you see. And these were commercial shows.
And that was all your rehearsal and everything,
everything,
right?
Everything. Uh-huh. An hour's rehearsal. Which, mm-hmm. And then come back. So that was an hour and a half. But even in those days, $5.85 for an hour and a half wasn't very good pay.
Well, it wasn't a continuous hour and a half either. You had an hour rehearsal, and then you had
the show,
a 15-minute show, and then you had to go away early
and
come back.
And do the other 15-minute show. So
you were really confined, more or less.
That's right, and it was travel time and everything else. But that didn't last too long, because that's when we went to Equity and Screen Actors Guild and said, hey, we need a union.
Mm-hmm. And then immediately after it was formed, then there were minimum standards set for all of this.
Yes.
And wasn't that, there was a doubling situation too, wasn't there?
Yes.
People, a producer would often invite.
Well, those things came later. Uh-huh. Those things came later. We got organized in a fairly good, at a fairly good clip, and we were back then by the AFL before it became AFL-CIO. Mm-hmm. And the other two unions gave us, in the aggregate, $20,000 to start our union. And we did,
mm-hmm.
which wasn't a whole lot of money either to start an organization like that. But we had a lot of volunteers and worked out pretty well. But the thing is that the code that we work under now, which is constantly changing, as you know, every time we have a convention, the code changes a little bit, was not as detailed then as it is now. And sure, we did have, they did away with the artists service, the NBC artist service kickback and that kind of thing. But, and they did away, they did have a minimum pay and so forth. I very rarely worked for minimum.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I didn't seem to have to. On spot shows, yes, but not on where I had a regular part running or something of that sort.
Did when you were involved with Life Can Be Beautiful, to get back to that again for a moment, was your involvement there totally on the East Coast, or did the show switch to the West Coast too?
No, we did it all from New York.
All from New York.
Yes, uh-huh.
It continued
the whole
then
show,
after
yes,
you
yep.
left. It stayed from New
yes,
York.
Yes.
I'm trying to recall the names of the writers. It was one of the few shows.
Carl
that
Bixby.
Yeah, the writers got credit on the air almost all the time.
And there
Carl
was another
Bixby
writer,
and,
Becker.
Don Becker.
Right.
Don Becker, yeah.
And,
It's drawn from life itself, I think they would say, or some drawn
something
from life.
Something like that.
In other words,
one
a story
them.
Based on,
true,
a story.
True love, yeah.
But it was a story
actually,
about Papa David and...
Papa David, Chi-Chi, and Stephen.
Mm-hmm.
And Papa David had ran a bookshop, mm-hmm. which he called the Slightly Red Bookshop, and we had trouble explaining that after we had the communist scare thing. But Papa David said there was no such thing as a second-hand book, there was only a slightly red book, and that was why he had the Slightly Red Bookshop. And Stephen lived with Papa Day, but he was in a wheelchair. He had been a cripple for many years, and I don't think that was ever explained. And he was a lawyer.
Stephen.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And Chi-Chi ran in from the street for protection from someone who was chasing her one day, and that was how we all started and got together to be one big happy family, which we really were.
Did you have a good time with it?
Yes, we really did. We loved it. We loved the show. We loved the director. And the writers we rarely saw unless we were unlucky, except for Carl. Carl Carl was a darling, but Don was kind of difficult.
You didn't care for the writers too much.
I liked Don. Uh-huh. I mean, I liked Carl.
Carl
Bixby. Yes, Carl.
Why was that?
He was an unpleasant personality.
Oh, okay.
That's all.
Simple as that.
Yes.
And didn't have anything to do with the fact that they were writers.
No.
Oh, I see.
No. But you see, now, actually, when you stop to think of all the people who were involved very closely with that show, Oliver Barber, Ollie Barber, who was our dear darling director, he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Papa David is gone. Ralph Locke. Stephen John Holbrook is gone. Toby, who was the other boy in Chi-Chi's life constantly, Carl Eastman, he's gone. I don't know about Dr. Markham, who was Charles Webster, not to be confused with Chuck Webster, because there were two of them. Bud Collier, who played Markham's son after Dorothy Kilgallen's husband. What was his name?
Dick Comer.
Mm-hmm. Dick Comer played Barry Markham first. And then... Bud Collier, did he play? No, he played Phil. He didn't play Barry Markham, I'm sorry. He played Phil, who was a young doctor who came to live at the bookshop. They're all dead. And here I am.
And there you are. Life can be beautiful. See, you're still alive.
Hopefully, yeah. So far, I'm healthy.
And for a long time, too, I'm sure.
One would hope.
When you came to Hollywood then, did you find it a problem getting radio jobs?
Well, no, see, I came out with a show.
And that was the...
Carlton Moore sent for Les and me to New York to play in The Woman in My House, and that's how we came
out. The Woman in My House was kind of a revised version, wasn't it?
A daytime.
Set in Chicago, actually.
A daytime
version. Of One
Man's
version. Family. Yeah.
A daytime version, 15 minutes, 5 days a week. And Les played the part that Michael Raffetto had played in The Family, which was Paul, the part of Paul, only he was called Jeff, and I played the elder sister, who would have been Hazel, and she was called Virginia. And we came out, Les drove out early because he also had had an agent out here had come to New York and seen him in Detective Story on Broadway, and he had come out on a fishing expedition anyway for new talent, and he had told Les that he could get him into pictures anytime he wanted to come out. And Les had suddenly decided that New York was too much for him, and he wanted to come out to California, and I was dragged kicking and screaming. I didn't want to come out here. I was born in California, and I never liked it. But I had very little choice. And that's my cuckoo clock.
The cuckoo, yeah.
Yeah. My mother came out with us, and she had an apartment in Hollywood, and we bought a house out in the valley, because Les wanted that, and I wanted to live in Beverly Hills. The whole thing... was not well brought out, but we lived in the valley for 7 years, and we came.
And you were equally busy on radio then as you were in New York.
Not
then,
quite
right?
as busy. I did do some television on Kinescope, which was not quite as bad as live. I did The Woman in My House. I did some Richard Diamonds. I did This Woman's Secret, which was an NBC program. I did Stars Over Hollywood. I guess I was fairly busy when you stopped to think about it, yes.
Did you get into anything on a regular basis in television then in the 50s?
No, never did. I did a lot of television shows, from Dragnet on, up or down, whichever you prefer. But I never had a series. I'm still hoping.
What are you doing these days, Alice Reinhart?
Well, these days I'm keeping very busy with a we're doing a history. The Women's Committee of AFTRA is doing a history of AFTRA, and I am the official historian of that. So I'm keeping fairly busy with that. The reason I have gray hair today is I'm going on a call back on an interview for a television show sometime this week. I haven't got the appointment yet, the time of the appointment yet, but they want gray hair, so I went to my hairdresser and had him put a gray rinse on my blonde hair. And then, too, I am the chairman of the Nostalgia Night Committee of the Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters, which is, you know the organization.
Yes, a very important one out here.
And we have Nostalgia Nights the last Thursday of almost every month during the fall, with the exception of November, which is always Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm. And so November, December, we usually have it about the 18th of December, something like that, whenever the Thursday night falls. And the rest of the time, from September through May, we have them the last Thursday of every month. And I have kind of a nice one coming up in September. Arch Obler is coming on. He's originally from Chicago, too,
right,
I think.
Uh-huh.
And the last one that I had in May, Carlton Morris came up. I think I told you this when we talked on the phone.
Uh-huh.
Carlton Morris came up from San Francisco, and we had a Carlton Morris night. And, of course, we always play the shows, and then the people who were involved discuss them, and the audience asks questions. It's a very informal thing, but it has grown from 11 people in the audience to where we can barely accommodate them, 75, 72, 75 people.
It's nice that there are things like that going on out here in the West Coast where there are so many people.
Well,
we would love to have something like that in the Midwest,
but they've all gone away.
This
is the Nostalgia Nights are all invitational because they are held in a financial institution.
Mm-hmm.
You see, Bob Amundsen, who is the vice president of Home Savings and Loan out here. I don't know whether the Midwest and the East have SNLs the way we do out here. I think
we have a lot of them.
You do have a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Home Savings, I think, is one of the largest.
Mm-hmm.
And they bought the corner when NBC was torn down in Hollywood and rebuilt in Burbank for television. They bought the corner on Sunset and Vine where NBC stood. And so now Bob, who is a great radio buff, gave us a beautiful lounge, nicely furnished, and where we hold our Nostalgia Nights, and then there's a control room, and then there's a very large room for our archives. We have the largest collection in the world, I think, of scripts and tapes and memorabilia and pictures of old radio.
It's great to know that that is being preserved and enhanced.
Yes, it has to be, and Les fought like a demon, and he finally got it through for an audio history of careers of people. And when he can't do it, I do it. We interview, just as you're interviewing me now, people to put it on tape in our archives so that we can have a history of the people, because a lot of us, most of us are not young anymore, the dramatic radio people. We've been in this business 45 years. And some more. Les has been in the business since he was 3. I've been in the business since I was 15. And some of us are even older than that, if that's possible.
It's nice to be able to have that and to talk with people like you who have made the industry what it was and who contributed all that to a very important art form. It really was.
We really feel so.
Form.
And of course, as Les has often said, it was the only industry and probably the only art form that was born, flourished, and died in 30 years.
I never gave it that much thought, but that's right. It did, didn't it? It was 30-year history, and that was about it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You contributed a lot to it, though, and I thank you very much for sharing some of those memories with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoy talking about it. I like to reminisce.
Thank you, Alice Reinhart.